Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a report on hundreds of research studies says plastic pollution at sea is reaching worrying levels. The report warned that pollution will continue to grow even if immediate action is taken to stop such waste from reaching the world's oceans. The report, by Germany's Alfred Wegener Institute, examined almost 2,600 research studies on plastic pollution. "We find it in the deepest ocean trenches, at the sea surface, and in Arctic sea ice," said biologist Melanie Bergman. She is one of the report's writers. Some areas, such as the Mediterranean, East China, and Yellow Seas, already contain dangerous levels of plastic. Other bodies of water risk becoming increasingly polluted in the future, the report found. The writers reported that almost every kind of ocean animal has been affected by plastic pollution. That pollution is harming important environmental systems, such as coral reefs and mangroves. As plastic breaks down into smaller pieces, it is eaten by many different sea creatures, from whales to turtles to extremely small plankton. Bergman said, "Getting that plastic out of the water again is nearly impossible." She added that policymakers should center their efforts on preventing any more pollution from entering the oceans. Some of the studies showed that even if this were to happen today, the amount of microplastic in the seas would keep increasing for years to come, she said. Matthew McLeod is a professor of environmental science at Stockholm University. He was not involved in the report. He said it appeared to be a good examination of existing studies on the effects of plastic pollution. "The part that can be argued about is whether there is enough evidence to warrant aggressive action that will certainly disrupt current practices for plastic production, use, and disposal," he said. McLeod was involved in a separate study that also found that immediate measures are required because of the possible worldwide effects. Heike Vesper is with the World Wildlife Fund, the environmental group that ordered the Wegener Institute study. She said, "People can help reduce plastic pollution by changing their behavior." But she added that governments must help in dealing with the problem. The United Nations Environment Assembly is expected to meet and discuss the plastic pollution problem later this month.
The Islamic State, or IS, group enslaved Rosa Barakat when she was a young Yazidi girl. IS has been defeated, but she still feels like a prisoner. She was 11 years old when she was captured and enslaved. Thousands of Yazidi women and girls were taken when the militants overran northern Iraq in their cruel 2014 campaign. Barakat was taken from her family in the town of Sinjar, the home of the ancient religious Yazidi minority, to Syria. She was sold and sexually attacked. She gave birth to a child, a boy she has since lost. Now, at 18, she speaks little of her native Kurdish language, Kurmanji. Eventually, her IS captors gave her a choice: become a Muslim and marry an IS fighter, or be sold again. She changed her religion, she says, to avoid being sold. She married a Lebanese man chosen for her. He supplied food and equipment for IS fighters. He was better than most, she said. At 13, she gave birth to a son, Hud. They lived for a while in Raqqa. As IS began losing control, Barakat fled with her husband. He later died in the fighting. Barakat is one of many Yazidi women who came of age under the cruel rule of IS. Troubled and lost, many struggle to move on from the past. Iraq's Yazidi community has forced women returning to Sinjar to give up their children as a condition to return. Many of the children have ended up in an orphanage in northeastern Syria. Faruk Tuzu is co-chair of Yazidi House, a group of Yazidi organizations in northeastern Syria. Speaking of the young women, he said, after so much shock and abuse, they don't believe in anything anymore. They don't belong anywhere. Today, over 2,800 Yazidi women and children are still missing, said Tuzu. Some are building new lives outside the community, believing that if they return, they would be killed. Others fear being separated from their children, fathered by IS members. That is our mistake, that we didn't allow the children to stay with their mothers, said Tuzu. Barakat spoke to the AP from a safe house run by Tuzu's group. By early 2019, as IS rule was failing, U.S.-backed Kurdish-Syrian Democratic Forces surrounded Balkhuz. Safe passage was offered to women and children. At this point, Barakat could have stepped forward and identified herself as a Yazidi and sought safety. But instead, she held her baby, Hud, in her arms and walked out of the town with other IS wives. Barakat went to a nearby village rather than going into a camp. With the help of IS sympathizers, she ended up in Idlib, in northwestern Syria, in a home for IS widows. She told the AP that Hud died after an airstrike in Idlib. She found work at a clothing market and dreamed of a new life in Turkey. Kurdish internal security forces caught her last month. She had been waiting to be taken by smugglers across the Syria-Turkey border. She was held and questioned for days. One investigator held up an old photo found on her mobile phone. A young Yazidi woman in an IS slave market, and asked her to explain. The words just came out. "That is my sister," Barakat said. Once she told the truth, Barakat was taken to a safe house in Syria's Hasaka province, where the Yazidi community welcomed her. "I was in shock to hear their kind words and to be welcomed the way I was," she said. I'm Jill Robbins.
The American Space Agency, NASA, says it will keep supporting the International Space Station through 2030. After that, it plans to retire the ISS and use privately developed stations. NASA recently released a report on its plans for transitioning from the ISS to one or more space stations that would be developed by private companies. The ISS has been operating for more than 20 years. The first piece of the Floating Space Laboratory was launched into space in 1998. The ISS has been widely praised as a scientific success. But NASA and its international partners have recognized that it cannot continue to operate forever. Late last year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced it was committed to extending ISS operations through 2030. In a statement, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said the plan would include continued cooperation with international partners from Europe, Japan, Canada, and Russia. Last month, NASA released a report to the United States Congress on its plans to keep the ISS operating over the next 8 years. The report said NASA officials look forward to the final years of the ISS being its most productive. This will be a time in which NASA will aim to support deep space exploration and continue to return medical and environmental benefits to humanity, the report reads. NASA notes in the report that the ISS is currently the busiest it has ever been, with the addition of private space companies now transporting astronauts and supplies. In the future, NASA says its goal is to completely move to privately developed space laboratories for all its space lab needs. This way, NASA will be paying the space station operators only for the goods and services the agency needs. NASA has already chosen three private American companies to develop future space stations. One of them will be led by Blue Origin. The company announced plans last October for its Orbital Reef station. The developers say Orbital Reef will support 10 people in an area of about 830 cubic meters. That is nearly the size of the ISS. The station will be designed to serve science researchers, space agencies, nations without space programs, and technology and manufacturing companies. Another developer will be space services company NanoRacks. It has said it is teaming up with Voyager Space and Lockheed Martin to develop the first ever free-flying commercial space station. The companies say they expect the space laboratory named Starlab to be operational by 2027. The third company, Northrop Grumman, said it will develop a free-flying space station for NASA. In an announcement in December, the defense contractor said the station is expected to support activities including science, tourism, and industrial experimentation. In its report to Congress, NASA also describes its plans for retiring the ISS. When it is ready to end service, the space agency said it would first take steps to begin slowly lowering the operational altitude of the ISS. Then it would attempt to carry out a controlled deorbit of the floating lab with the help of additional space vehicles. The plan is to target the space station toward the South Pacific Ocean at a place called Point Nemo. This is a stretch of open water between New Zealand and the southernmost part of South America. The U.S. National Ocean Service identifies Point Nemo as the point in the ocean that is farthest from land. The area has repeatedly been used by space agencies seeking to safely deorbit old spacecraft so they do not cause problems in space or on the ground. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Vice President Calvin Coolidge became president in 1923, following the death of President Warren Harding. Coolidge quickly gained the trust of most Americans by investigating the crimes of Harding's top officials. The conservative economic policies of the new president also won wide support. Coolidge had 1 year to prove his abilities to the American people before the election of 1924. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about that election.
Coolidge was a quiet man who believed in limited government policies, but his silence hid a fighting political spirit. Coolidge had worked for many years to gain the White House. He would not give it up without a struggle. Coolidge moved quickly after becoming president to gain control of the Republican Party. He named his own advisors to important jobs, and he replaced a number of officials with people whose loyalty he could trust. Most Republicans liked Coolidge. They felt his popular policies would make him a strong candidate in the presidential election. For this reason, Coolidge faced only one serious opponent for the Republican presidential nomination in 1924. Coolidge's opponent was the great automobile manufacturer Henry Ford of Michigan. Ford had been a Democratic candidate for the Senate in 1918. He lost that election. But after the election, some people in his company began to call for Ford to be the Republican presidential nominee in 1924.
Ford was one of history's greatest inventors and manufacturers. But he had limited skills in politics. Ford was poorly educated. He had extreme opinions about a number of groups. He hated labor unions, the stock market, dancing, smoking, and drinking alcohol. But most of all, Ford hated Jews. He produced a number of publications accusing the Jewish people of organizing international plots. At first, Ford appeared to be a strong opponent to Coolidge. But soon he realized that Coolidge was too strong politically. His economic policies were popular among the people, and the nation was at peace. The party could not deny Coolidge's nomination. Ford himself put an end to his chances by telling the nation that it was perfectly safe with Coolidge. Calvin Coolidge won the presidential nomination easily at the 1924 Republican Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. The Republican delegates chose Charles Dawes of Illinois to run with him as the vice presidential candidate.
The Democratic Party was much more divided. Many of the groups that traditionally supported Democratic candidates now were fighting against each other. For example, many farmers did not agree on policies with people living in cities. The educated did not agree with uneducated people. And many Protestant workers felt divided from Roman Catholic and Jewish workers. These differences made it hard for the Democratic Party to choose a national candidate. There was little spirit of compromise. Two main candidates campaigned for the Democratic nomination. The first was former Treasury Secretary William McAdoo. McAdoo had the support of many Democrats because of his strong administration of the railroads during the World War. Democratic voters in southern and western states liked him because of his conservative racial policies and his opposition to alcohol. The second main candidate was Alfred Smith, the governor of New York. Smith was a Roman Catholic. He was very popular with people in the eastern cities, Roman Catholics, and supporters of legal alcohol. But many rural delegates to the convention did not trust him.
The Democratic Party convention met in New York City. It quickly became a battle between the more liberal delegates from the cities and the more conservative delegates from rural areas. It was July. The heat was intense. Speaker after speaker appealed to the delegates for votes. One day passed, then another. For 9 days, the nation listened on the radio as the delegates argued about the nomination. The delegates voted 95 times without success. Finally, McAdoo and Smith agreed to withdraw from the race. Even then, the delegates had to vote 8 more times before they finally agreed on compromise candidates. The Democratic delegates finally chose John Davis to be their presidential nominee. Davis was a lawyer for a major bank. He had served briefly under President Wilson as ambassador to Britain. The delegates also chose Charles Bryan to be the vice presidential candidate. Bryan was the younger brother of the famous Democrat and populist leader William Jennings Bryan.
There also was a third party in the 1924 election. Many of the old progressive supporters of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson opposed the choices of the Republicans and Democrats. They thought the country needed another candidate to keep alive the spirit of reform. Progressive candidates had done well in the congressional election of 1922. But following the election, communists had gained influence in one of the major progressive parties. Most progressives did not want to join with communists, so they formed a new progressive party. The new party named Senator Robert La Follette, of Wisconsin to be its presidential candidate. La Follette campaigned for increased taxes on the rich and public ownership of water power. He called for an end to child labor and limits on the power of the courts to interfere in labor disputes. And La Follette warned the nation about the dangers of single, large companies gaining control of important industries.
Coolidge won the 1924 election easily. He won the electoral votes of 35 states to just 12 for Davis of the Democrats. La Follette won only Wisconsin, his home state. Coolidge also won more popular votes than the other two candidates together. The American people voted for Coolidge partly to thank him for bringing back honesty and trust to the White House following the crimes of the Harding administration. But the main reason was that they liked his conservative economic policies and his support of business.
La Follette's Progressive Party died following the 1924 election. Most of his supporters later joined the Democrats, but the reform spirit of their movement remained alive through the next 4 years. They were difficult years for progressives. Conservatives in Congress passed laws reducing taxes for corporations and richer Americans.
Progressives fought for reforms in national agriculture policies. Most farmers did not share in the general economic growth of the 1920s. Instead, their costs increased while the price of their products fell. Many farmers lost their farms. Farmers and progressives wanted the federal government to create a system to control prices and the total supply of food produced. They said the government should buy and keep any extra food that farmers produced, and they called for officials to help them export food. Coolidge and most Republicans rejected these ideas. They said it was not the business of a free government to fix farm prices, and they feared the high costs of creating a major new government department and developing export markets. Coolidge vetoed three major farm reform bills following his election.
The debate over farm policy was in many ways like the debate over taxes or public controls on power companies. There was a basic difference of opinion about the proper actions of government. More conservative Americans believed the purpose of government was to support private business, not to control it. But more liberal Americans believed that government needed to do more to make sure that citizens of all kinds could share the nation's wealth more equally. Coolidge and the Republicans were in control in the 1920s. For this reason, the nation generally stayed on a conservative path. The Democrats and progressives would have to wait until later to put many of their more liberal ideas into action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.